Senator, why don't you talk some of about loving kindness? I'd be happy to. I'm going to talk some about loving kindness, and then have us do walking meditation, as I said, using that particular technique, and then sit, and then have time for some discussion before we close for the day. The word in Pali, as I'm sure many of you know, the language of the original Buddhist text, that's usually translated as loving kindness is metta, M-E-T-T-A. And those of you who've been to the Insight Meditation Society or have seen our literature know that up above the doorway at IMS, the Insight Meditation Society, is that word, metta. So we first bought the place. We moved in on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1976, and it was owned by the Catholic Church. It was run by the Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament, and that's what it said up above the doorway, Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament. So on a very cold day, we got someone to get up on a very tall ladder, and we said, please play with those letters until you come up with something that said something about us. So he got up on the ladder and played with all the letters and came up with metta. And what then ensued was a tremendous debate. You know, should we keep it up? We're not in India anymore, we're not in Asia anymore, no one knows what it means. But on the other hand, it's so expressive of what we really care about, and went back and forth. And finally the point of view that photos should stay there prevailed, which I was very happy about because it was my point of view. I like it a lot because, you know, someone will call, say a delivery person will call for directions, and whoever answers the phone can say, it's a large brick building with white pillars, and there's this word up on top, metta. And then they usually say, what does that mean? And we say, it means love, or it means loving kindness. Loving kindness is the common translation. I'm sure it's quite a good one. My concern usually about it is that it may not be a word we use much in casual conversation. And so my concern is that might make the quality itself seem somewhat arcane and removed from day-to-day life and precious in the negative sense of the word. Whereas really that's not what metta is meant to convey at all. Sometimes we do translate it as love, but that's so very complicated, you know, because we mean so very many things when we use the word love. Sometimes we really frankly mean a medium of exchange. You know, I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake. I will love you as long as you respond in a particular way, or as long as the following 15 conditions are met. I once used that example somewhere and someone in the room called out, only 15? Yeah, so I will love you as long as however many conditions are met. We all know that state, and it's not, you know, to heap scorn upon that state, but we also know that state of attachment, a very conditional love, is so fragile. It's so brittle. How long will it really be if we are saying to ourselves, in effect, I will love you as long as you never make a mistake? It's not going to be long. You know, before that sense of love and care is threatened by a change in circumstance, by not getting what we want, by our having made a mistake, or someone else not behaving in the way we would wish. And so when we talk about metta, we're looking for something that is more steadfast, that's more resourceful, that is more open. It's very different than what we normally might consider love. So it takes some big exploration, really, to examine just what we mean by that word, to use it in this context. The traditional translation is friendship, and so the practice of loving kindness is the practice of developing the art of friendship toward ourselves and ultimately toward all of life. I don't think of loving kindness really as an emotion very much, or a sentiment. It's when we do think of it as an emotion or a sentiment that one can get a little bit squeamish about the development of this practice. Somebody, it's actually one of the favorite bits of feedback or commentary I've ever gotten about loving kindness practice. Do you have Valentine's Day here? So somebody said to me, I absolutely detest doing loving kindness meditation because it reminds me of a continually enforced Valentine's Day. You know, like on the count of three, you will be filled with love. Something as though it were coercive and as though the quality of metta were pretentious, you know, or just put upon. Sometimes people think of loving kindness as, you know, taking our normally seething emotions and putting a little cap on it, this seeming veneer of loving kindness, and it's not meant to be that at all. It's something very, very different than that. And sometimes I think we also live in a sort of a sorrowful time in the sense that our notion of love can have degenerated so much that we think of it as a weakness, we think of it as something foolish, something that will keep us from being effective, from being powerful. But really, when we look at that quality, and we look again and we look again, there are extraordinary facets to loving kindness, to kindness, to caring, to compassion. So classically, there are four qualities that are taught together, and I'll talk about them tomorrow much more extensively. It's loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, which is the ability when we witness someone's success or good fortune not to fall so sway to the voice which commonly arises within us that says, ooh, I would be happier if you had a little bit less going for you right now. You don't have to lose everything, but if the light could just dim a little bit, I would be quite pleased. So, sympathetic joy is the opposite of that, the ability to actually take the light in the happiness of others. And then the last quality is equanimity, or the balance of mind that is the voice of wisdom, of seeing things as they actually are. So I'll go into much more detail tomorrow about the four of them and how they relate to each other. Sometimes you can almost use them. Certainly loving kindness and compassion are often used synonymously, although within that framework there's some distinctions that can also be made. But that sense of caring, of particularly that sense of connection, is the hallmark of the sense of metta. It's not necessarily a feeling, even. It's kind of a knowing. It's almost like a worldview, but not in a cerebral sense. It's a very deep knowing of how connected we are. So that it's said that the force of loving kindness can come from different directions, with two main sources. And it's not the only sources, but they were the only source. But there are two sources that are kind of predominant in the evolution, the growth, the nurturing, the cultivation of loving kindness. And the first is insight or clear seeing, with the idea being that if we really could understand the nature of things, the nature of life, we would see how connected we all are. This isn't an artifice, it's not self-conscious, it's not self-righteous. It's just how things are. And so there's a kind of responsiveness to that vision that is loving kindness. And it can be very simple, but it's just knowing that we're connected, whoever we are. So an exercise I like to do just sitting in front of a room full of people is to say something like, let's all right now for a few moments just reflect on how many beings are involved and are sitting in this room together right now. There's none of us just arrive, what the fuck, right? I think turn that gate. You know, every moment of life is this confluence of conditions coming together, moving, changing, coming apart. Confluence of conditions. That's the nature of things. So how many people maybe gave you a book? Or read you a poem, or told you about their meditation practice, or told you about this organization? This moment in time for us is layers of relationship and influence and connection and contact. How many beings? You know, sometimes as I said, I went to India the first time as a student. So I went with my student loans and, you know, scholarships and things like that. And so I think about that whole structure, State University of New York. You know, which sent me there, in fact, and those professors, and, you know, layers and layers and layers of connections. And sometimes when I do this exercise for myself, I also make the point of including those people who have really challenged me. Not just the ones that I find kind of annoying, you know, but the ones where some action has really brought me to an edge so that I've said, I need to be free in a way that I'm not, or I need to find another source of happiness, very different from what I have been relying on. Because they're a part of me being here too. And those beings involved in the clothing that we're wearing, or the food that we just ate, even if it wasn't an animal product per se, you know, how many creatures live in the earth? And who planted that seed of whatever and harvested that crop and transported it and prepared it or sold it to us? Like layers and layers and layers. That's this moment. That's the truth. So with that understanding of life, there's just naturally a different sense rather than a construct of self and other and us and them, which can be held so powerfully. We just see things differently. And the power of it is to this trip. It's not made up, you know, to be sentimental or new agey or woo-woo or whatever, you know. It's actually how things are. That's why it's powerful. It's like the truth is powerful. So my friend Bob Thurman is a professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia University in New York. He has this kind of illustration he uses a lot, and I actually use it a whole lot more than he does. And that is, this will translate nicely. He says, imagine you're in a subway with all these other people that you don't know, and these Martians come and they zap the subway car so that those of you who are in there are going to be together forever. He says, what do? You know, somebody's hungry, feed them. Somebody's freaking out, and try to calm them down. Not because you necessarily like them at all or approve of them, but because you're going to be there together forever. That's loving kindness. It's knowing that, because you know what? Kind of true, actually. That vision of life that recognizes how connected we all are and responds. It doesn't mean we don't do anything, that we're not strong, that we don't, you know, try to protect somebody or keep somebody from behaving in a certain way. We do. But the place we're coming from doesn't have to be that great gulf of alienation. Like that's the other out there. And this, again, we'll explore more tomorrow. So Bob uses that illustration, and I use it constantly. And then I often talk about, these days, this time a couple of years ago now, a few years ago, I was in New York City, and I was flying to Tucson, Arizona, where I was going to hear the Dalai Lama do some teachings, and I was going a day early because I was going to do a talk myself. So my plane ended up sitting on the runway at LaGuardia Airport, and what I now look back on, sometimes called the breakdown of civilization, because it got hotter and hotter and hotter, and people got angrier and angrier and angrier, and started yelling, screaming, getting you off this airplane. And at one point, the pilot kind of took command. He got on the PA system and he said, no one is leaving this aircraft. You know, and I wasn't feeling all that chipper myself. I was thinking, oh. You know, I couldn't get in touch with the people in Tucson who were supposed to pick me up, so I don't know what was going to happen with them. And I kept thinking, I'm paying rent in New York City. I could be in my apartment. I don't need to be sitting on the airplane. I can go in tomorrow. You know, but there wasn't any getting off the airplane. And at one point, quite unbidden, that image that Bob uses, that I use so much, just came up in my mind. Imagine you're on a subway. And these Martians come, and they zap the subway car so that you're going to be together forever. And I just looked around the airplane, and I thought, maybe these are my people. And it was quite interesting. It made a big difference. First of all, it was interesting to take something, as I was saying this morning, that one can hold as sort of an abstract value and try to make it real. And it was also kind of fascinating because in the Buddhist psychology, one of the antidotes for anger is interest. You know, if we're angry at someone or something, we want to push it away, which is very different energetically than when we take an interest in it. And I suddenly found this great big interest in all these people since we're going to be together forever, you know? And I wasn't just saying, why are you screaming? Where are you going? You know? Can't wait till tomorrow. It was just very interesting to make up a little story and not to be pushing them away in that way. So that's kind of the sense of loving kindness. Doesn't mean you like everybody. And it certainly doesn't mean you don't take any action when that's appropriate or skillful. But that core sense of being cut off, being alone, being separate, that's what dissolves. Because it's untrue. It's manufactured. So that wisdom or insight is actually one great, great source of the power of loving kindness. And the other, another, is actually developing a flexibility of awareness so that we can change how we are paying attention. And that will also have the fruit of the great cultivation or development of loving kindness. So, for example, what do we pay attention to? You know, let's say you're the kind of person who at the end of the day has the habit of sort of assessing yourself from that day, like looking back as though to say, how did I do today? And let's just say you're the kind of person who tends to only remember, or perhaps to obsess about all the mistakes that you made. It's like the 50 great things that you did, gone. All you can remember is that really stupid thing you said at lunch at that meeting. It's as though our whole sense of who we are and all that we will ever be just collapses around that comment we made. So the perspective of loving kindness is almost like one of asking ourselves, anything else happened today? Like maybe anything good within me? It's not sort of make-believe or distortion. It's not as though you were saying, oh, wasn't that a brilliant and witty thing I said at lunch? Maybe it was really stupid. And there are consequences for that. But that's not all that we are, ever. So we play with our awareness. Look for the good. That's interesting as an exercise. It takes some effort. We're not used to it. by and large, it's much easier to obsess about and fixate on what's wrong. But it's a kind of interesting effort, you know? It's not a strain, and it's not pushing, it's not coercive, but we're playing, you know? I'm so used to just focusing on what's wrong. What happens when I look for the good within? So that's my very favorite thing to say about loving kindness practice. What happens? What happens? And how do we pay attention? I can remember many years ago when I was living in India, a friend of mine went off to Sikkim, which at that time was a protectorate of India, to see this very great, renowned Tibetan Lama, the 16th Karmapa. Who was really very eminent, very powerful. And my friend returned, and he said that the Karmapa greeted his appearance, his arrival, as though it were just about the most important thing that had ever happened to the Karmapa in his life, which I'm quite sure it was not. And then my friend said he didn't convey that impression through great pomp and circumstance, but rather by paying absolute, complete attention to him. So that, my friend said, the subjective experience of that was the sense of the feeling of being totally loved. Completely loved. And when he told me that, and this of course was way back, like when I was living in India, and there was no like, cell phones, no email, no faxes, and very little. But even there, I remember I felt kind of saddened by that. Because I thought, how many times do I talk to people, and I'm not really there? You know, I'm thinking about someone else, or a thing I need to do, or I'd rather be meditating, or whatever. And nowadays, it's like an explosion of other things to do, but even then, I thought, you know what? It wouldn't take that much. Just to gather my attention, just as we've been doing this morning, to actually be there. It wouldn't take that much. So how will we pay attention? Can we be full-hearted? Can we be full? That is like an act of loving kindness. And who do we pay attention to? Who do we ignore? Who do we look through indifference? Who forms the other, anyway? Through callousness, through indifference, as well as antipathy. You know, what about all those many beings that play some role in our lives, or creatures that we don't really consider to be life? Who is the other? So within the classical unfolding of the loving kindness practice, the practice is first of all done through silent repetition of certain phrases, which we'll go into in a few moments. And those phrases are the expressions of the heart which we offer to ourselves, to a variety of others that we have different kinds of relationships to. And in that classical unfolding, there's a category that I really love because I think it expresses so well the very nature of loving kindness practice, and that's the category of the neutral person. So a neutral person is someone we don't strongly like or dislike. We feel kind of neutral toward them. And I think it's so interesting to examine what happens as we offer loving kindness to a neutral person, because it's expressive of the very nature of the practice. So here's the kind of person we usually don't really notice completely because we feel kind of neutral toward them. And what we are doing, in effect, when we offer these phrases of loving kindness to this person is we are noticing them. We're paying attention rather than neglecting or ignoring or looking through someone. And over time, something really shifts. So my very favorite story about this, which I've told many times, has to do with every year at the Insight Meditation Society, I teach a 7-day intensive retreat in loving kindness practice. And we go through all these different categories. And quite some years ago, a friend of mine came to the course, and, you know, we just did the whole lay of the land of the practice. And then I didn't see her again for about 6 months when I was leading retreat somewhere else. And she came up to me there, and she was all kind of beaming and shining, and she said to me, "I've fallen in love with my drag queen." And I thought, wow, that's so great. And I knew her romantic history. I knew that she wanted to start dating again. And I was like, oh, okay. And she could tell what I was assuming just from seeing the expression on my face. And she said, no, not romantically, but he was my neutral person back in the retreat I sat in Barry. And she said, now every single day when I meditate, I hold him in my heart and I wish him well. And she said, now I go into the store and I really want to see how he's doing. It like means something. So I thought that was wonderful and a perfect example. You know, it isn't, even though one could assume he was a perfectly fine dry cleaner, it wasn't necessarily that she felt obliged or indebted to offer him loving kindness. And it wasn't even that she learned of his particular sorrows or challenges. She was just paying attention instead of ignoring him. So that was the beginning of the story. And then probably 2 years went by and we didn't run into each other again. And then a magazine asked me to write an article on loving kindness. So, and I happened to run into her. And I said, well, would it be okay with you if I used your name and told your story? And she said, oh, that's fine. She said, you know, this is like 2 years later, I still go into that store. And I still like really want to see how he's doing. So I wrote the article, and then years went by. And I ran into her again. And I went up to her and I said, how's your dry cleaner? And she said, you know, I still go into that store and I still really want to see how he's doing. She said, I've moved on to the UPS person. And I thought, that was so great. And I was like, one by one. But really, it's just by the force of attention, which is remarkable. You know, so you're not trying to manufacture a feeling you don't have, and it's not a little gooey and you know, sentimental, like a continually enforced Valentine's Day. It's the extraordinary power of inclusion rather than exclusion, and paying attention rather than assuming or looking right through. And then we look also, you know, what about the creation of the other through bias, through prejudice, through antipathy, through ignorance, not just indifference, you know, but that kind of tremendous withholding. So what happens when we are willing to let go and really pay attention? It's a transformation. That's very powerful because it is also true. So that's what we are doing in loving kindness practice. We're actually developing a great flexibility in awareness. We're gathering our attention so that we're not so splintered and fragmented, so that we are whole and wholehearted. We are consciously changing the way we use our attention, so we're not so stuck in ruts that only seeing what's negative, pretty much, but really moving, changing, challenging, seeing what happens. And we are expanding the field of our attention so that we are actually much more present with those we might have ordinarily ignored or rejected. So that's the nature of loving kindness practice. That's what we're actually doing. So the mechanics of it, to start with, again, there are many, many methods and many styles and many ways of doing it, but the way I tend to teach it, has to do with the silent repetition of certain phrases, and that's the conduit for our attention. That's how we are paying attention. So the phrases being words are usually imperfect. And there's a balance in this practice. We want phrases that are general enough so that we can offer them to ourselves and offer them to others. In a way, one of the powers of this practice is concentration, and the way it arises most strongly is when we can rely on structure. You know, so we can basically use the same phrases, no matter who we are offering them to, ourselves or others. It doesn't mean we want to be imprisoned by structure. There's a lot of creativity and flexibility in the practice too, but we want to find a balance. So for example, it would not be that conducive to concentration and the power of concentration if we kept trying to find the perfect phrase and change them all the time with everybody, because we would just end up in a swirl of thinking. So you might be offering the phrases to yourself and thinking, you know, may I be happy? You think of a friend and you think, may you be happy? And then you think of a friend and you start out with, may you be happy? And then you think, well, maybe not you. You get really lazy when you get happy. May you be what? And we think, it's kind of even worse. Like, what about you, you know? And then we're just on. You know, you sort of don't have to, like, sit down meditation posture for that, you know? So we try to basically use the same phrases so that we can go deeper in concentration. But again, that doesn't mean you should feel imprisoned, you know? Someone comes to mind and in a kind of spontaneous, free-flowing way, you think of another phrase, it's fine, you know, don't feel, oh my God, I said content instead of happy. It's terrible. Not like that. But we do need the discipline by and large. It's a very relational practice. And so it would be very tempting to just endlessly think, rather than to have the power of the concentration by returning and returning and returning to the phrases. We'll talk much more about this too. So we choose certain phrases. In a sitting, we, generally speaking, begin with ourselves and offer the phrases to a variety of beings. I'll make some suggestions for walking practice, which we'll do first. And then we'll come back and I'll go further into the sound guidance for the sitting. So in loving kindness walking practice, again, you don't need to walk, but getting outside would be a very good thing. If you are walking at loving kindness practice, it could be at a normal pace. You don't need to slow down at all unless you really prefer to. And I will say again, eyes open. I'll also say silent repetition of certain phrases. Once I was teaching in Berkeley, California, we went out in the street to do our walking meditation, and either if I wasn't clear enough or someone misunderstood, because she came back in and she said, well, I marshaled up all my courage and I walked up to somebody and I said, may you be happy. And I thought, well, at least it's birthday. Yeah. So it's silent repetition of certain phrases. In both the sitting and the walking, don't struggle to feel something. The practice is actually working on a level well below emotion. It may not be encapsulated in an emotion. Doesn't mean nothing's happening. So don't worry about that. In the walking, we just walk. And I would suggest, again, there are many forms and many ways of doing it. My favorite way of doing it is to basically center the phrases on myself. So walking along, silently reciting, let's say, two or three phrases. May I be safe, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. And there are commonly four phrases that we use in the sitting, which we'll talk about later, but two or three or four phrases. Sometimes people like to match the phrases to the rhythm of their step. Sometimes they don't. It doesn't matter. It's the same light awareness that we have with the sensations, but instead it's like a light awareness on the repetition of these phrases as we walk along. Just repeating the phrases for oneself. And then, when someone comes strongly into your consciousness, you walk by somebody, you hear a bird, you hear a dog, you see a bug, just quickly include them and be happy. And then go back to the repetition of the phrases for yourself. The reason I like to kind of center on the phrases for oneself is that there's a lot of life out there, you know, you can get really jumbled, like, oh, be happy, be happy, be happy. So it kind of gives us a baseline, like a touchstone, and then we can just include it, and it's really fun. You know, like this guy after fixing the drain, you know, he's been there all day, you know. And I keep thinking, how's he feeling, you know, and people are walking, they're like, oh, he's you know, it's quite interesting because we don't know who's going to come by. Maybe your friend's dog and your dog. You know, but be happy. Let's just see what happens. You can do that. Okay, and once again, undoubtedly, you'll have to begin again the gazillion times. Doesn't matter. You know, just keep coming back to the repetition of the phrases. If we could be back here by quarter after, that would be good. and then we'll have a session. Okay, thank you.